You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Russians with Attitude.
Hi.
Hello.
I didn't hear as much attitude in your voices as I would have expected. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Nikolai and Kirill, proprietors of the Russians with Attitude podcast and Twitter feed, both of which have gained some prominence in some Western circles since the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. I've had you on the podcast before, and I've been on your podcast. I went back and listened to the beginning of the podcast last time you were on. And I spent like about 5 minutes kind of half apologizing for having you on. And the reason is because I know there are people out there who find it offensive that I would want to hear the perspective of Russians who support the war, which you do, or the special military operation, as I guess you call it. And I'll keep it briefer this time. I just believe in listening to all, you know, perspectives, basically. And I think America would be better off if we had a clearer understanding of the way various people view the world, including adversaries and allies and everyone. The other thing I covered early in the last podcast was why you're not visible to YouTube viewers, and you both explained you choose to remain anonymous on the internet. The last thing I'll say is if they want to be able to tell you apart, Nikolai has what I would call a pure Russian accent. Kirill has the accent of someone who has spent some time in Europe, which I gather you've done a fair amount of. Did that begin at an early age or only in adulthood?
In childhood.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess without further ado, I mean, I want to talk about a lot of stuff. The state of the war, where you think it's headed, how much territory you think Putin would like to acquire if he could keep acquiring it. I want to talk about Navalny and politics in Russia, and how the war has affected political support for Putin in Russia, and how other things, specific things that have been part of the war, like maybe particular Ukrainian tactics and so on. But first, let me just start by saying I assume that you are happy as supporters of the Russian military campaign with the way things have been moving on the battlefield since the Ukrainian offensive in the summer more or less failed.
That's a pretty fair assessment, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are always things to criticize, of course, but or to be unhappy about, but the general trends seem quite favorable.
The things at the top of the list of your criticisms would be what the way the Russian side of the war is being conducted, or other things?
Well, it's many things, really. I guess, in the last 9 months or so, there is less to criticize than there was before. But I guess one point that is a problem that the Russian government has not really started solving that many would like to see being solved is the question of rotations from the front lines. Many soldiers have been on the front lines for a very long time now, and there are simply not enough. There is not enough military personnel to ensure that everyone, that people can be demobilized again, for example, like the people who have been mobilized from the reserves last year. There isn't really any information on when they're going to get demobilized. And that is becoming a problem for some people, because some of these people are like in their mid-30s, in their 40s. They have families, they have businesses, they have jobs. And although there have been legislative efforts to ease their situation, like employers can't fire people who have been mobilized. They have to make sure that their jobs wait for them when they get back and things like that. But still, it's it's just a problem to take people out of their normal life and not even tell them how long that's going to last.
Of course, the Ukrainians have a more severe kind of manpower issue, which is not enough men at the moment. I mean, they're talking about mobilization and so on. But right now, that seems to be one of the big problems. Nikolai, did you want to add anything or voice a criticism of anything?
Well, regarding the SMO, you do you mean? Well, I agree with Kirill.
Special military operation.
Yeah, it seems to be the biggest problem. But other than that, well, I really haven't put much thought about it because my baby was crying. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm a bit of a helicopter dad these days. So SMO is not at the top of the issues.
Does your baby have any complaints?
I think he does. He also is named Kirill, so maybe that's why he's complaining about something.
So
that's interesting. But the SMO, probably I talked about it already, but if I wasn't tuned in to the internet, to the television, I wouldn't notice that there is a war. So this whole pompous sayings like the invasion, the war, well, is it a war if you don't feel it? It's not like I try to lessen it or whitewash it or whatever, but I think the war is something that all the people are acutely aware of. And this is the special military operation is not just a propaganda term, but it feels this way as well. And it's a calculated move on the part of the Russian government to make it feel as a weird operation, special operation, because it's very on the hush-hush. It's operated in very this kind of manner that if you are not involved directly or your relatives, you don't really recognize that it's happening.
You think the Russian public broadly is not all that conscious of the war, of course, or where it's going on, but on a day-to-day basis, you think unless they have a son or daughter or a nephew or something in the war, it's just not making an
I mean, they see it on TV. I mean, they see it on TV and stuff, but people don't feel it that much in their day. Uh-huh. They don't feel it affect their daily lives very much. What Nikolai is saying, I believe.
Now, you tweeted something, and I don't know which one of you tweeted it on the RWA feed, but a couple weeks ago, you said it's genuinely unnerving how the Russian normie position is now more radical than my personal position in 2022, LOL. I take that to mean that in terms of your kind of hawkishness, like support of the war, the Russian public has kind of caught up with you, or did I misunderstand that?
No, that's what I meant. I mean, I'm judging by people I talk to, relatives and so on, who are not like very politicized, who are not very online, and just normal, regular Russian people. And they are saying things that I would not have said in at the beginning of the war, for example, in terms of how all things are moving so slowly, we should like bomb more and throw more bombs and things like that. And
now, is that because they want it to to end, or because they are now feeling the vibe and actually think that Russia is entitled to more of the land that was, that is maybe ethnically Russian or whatever?
They're angered. They are angry because, Ukrainians are bombing Belgorod. It's a response. It's not an entitlement to the lands. No one in Russia cares about more land. It's ridiculous, right? We have too much land as it is. It's a response to the Ukrainian response to the start of the SMO. It's an internal cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
somebody replied to that tweet of yours I just read said, can't imagine why, in other words, why support for the war has grown. And then that was sarcastic, of course. And then they had a picture of Alexander Dugin and his daughter. And of course, his daughter was killed via a bomb that I guess was intended for either him or both of them. And that I think we now know was planted by Ukrainian intelligence operatives.
I think the Washington Post ran an article about this, where they said that the CIA tried to convince them not to do it or something.
Yeah, you know, when that happened, I wrote a piece in my newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter, saying, I'm not sure this is a great idea, like from Ukraine's point of view, you know? It just seems like the kind of thing that is going to build support for, first of all, sympathy and support for what Dugin represents, which I think Westerners would call a fairly assertive form of, I'm sure I'll get this wrong when I say an assertive form of Russian nationalism. You'll say that's not nuanced enough, and we can maybe eventually get to that. But anyway, and presumably increased support for Putin. And I take it you would say I was kind of right about that, broadly speaking, that this, this, if anything, builds up support for the war in Russia.
Well, certainly attacks, like targeted attacks against civilians, galvanize the support for the military operations against Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And people get angry. It's similar to how when the Caucasus was on fire and you had insurgencies and the counterinsurgency going on. And then the Chechen Islamists started doing things like blowing up bombs in the subway in Moscow, taking school children hostage, gassing theaters, and so on. So things that are very obviously terrorist attacks that are aimed at killing civilians who are not involved in the conflict.
Yeah, I mean...
And this thing, this obviously, if you are a random civilian who is not involved in the war, and the other side starts killing people like you who are also civilians who are not involved in the war, then you start identifying with the people who fight those people. Who, I think it's fairly natural that this would galvanize support and make people angry and afraid in a bit, in a way, in a spiteful way. And there have been many of these targeted attacks, like the attack on the Christmas market in Belgorod, for example. That was also made people very angry.
That's in Russia. I think I may be able to make a slight factual correction. I'd be very proud of myself if I could. But when you said the gassing of the theater, the gas was actually supplied by the Russians, right?
Yes.
I mean, that was an attempt to take it back. So they had taken hostages, hundreds of hostages in the theater. There was an attempt to use gas that was going to pacify everyone, but it turned out killing a bunch of people.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
And what's your theory of the case on why Ukraine? I mean, by the standard rules of war, if a country invades you, you are entitled to fight back. But the question of whether, make encroachments on their territory, but the question of whether it's wise is another question. Do you have a theory? I can imagine two theories. One is that they think, apparently wrongly, at least so far, that the more the war exacts a toll on ordinary Russians and makes them live in fear, the more they'll want Putin to hurry up and end the war. And then the other theory would be a little more cynical, which is that they want it to be a wider war that NATO would get involved in. Am I missing an option? And does either of you have a theory?
I think it's partly the first thing you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think less so the second one. I don't think that is their goal. I think their second goal is more to have something to present to their own population that they can spin as a win. And there is a high correlation between Ukrainian setbacks on the battlefield and these media heavy attacks that happen in Russia, like the bombing of the Crimean Bridge, for example, or the shellings of Belgorod, or the attempts to attack Belgorod Oblast and Kursk Oblast, and so on. These things always happen things like that, or drone attacks against Moscow and things like that. They usually occur after some sort of thing happens in the war that is demoralizing to the Ukrainian side. And then something like this happens, and in the media cycle, it spins very fast, and they can forget about the demoralizing thing and focus on the thing that is a perceived win. I think it's that more than anything else, really.
Okay. Now, I want to... Nikolai, do you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, well, they perceive as a win lots of things, like Egyptian shark eating a Russian tourist is a win for Ukrainians. So there's
happened a long time ago. You're really hanging on to that grievance, aren't you, Nikolai?
It's not a grievance. It's a perfect portrayal of the mores and wishes of the Ukrainian nation, the Ukrainian political nation. So it's
for people who don't know, there was a Russian tourist somewhere got attacked by a shark and I guess killed. Yeah. And people were like celebrating it as if like he was responsible for the war or something. But, well, you see this a lot. And you've probably seen at least some of it on your own side. I don't know, but yeah. And you see it, I would say in Israel, Palestine and so on. But, okay. Anyway, I interrupt you. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I've never seen this type of behavior on the Russian side, like celebrating that some random Ukrainian across the world dies in a freak accident. I've never seen that. It's not because there's two sides are not equal here. We have very different attitudes and approaches, and we think of each other in a very different way. And that's why it's like a bit of a father-son relationship. And the latter is far more cruel. And the former don't really know, has no idea what to do sometimes, right?
You mean cruel. Russia is the father and Ukraine is the son in this analogy?
Okay. Sure.
It's
a family feud, yeah.
That is the way. I mean, that actually kind of leads into my next question. There's a tweet you did also pretty recently that I found kind of alarming, and I think a lot of people in the West would. And so I want to read parts of it. It speaks to some extent your reason for supporting the war. Now, last time you talked about your perception that ethnic Russians or Russian-speaking people in Ukraine had been, in some ways persecuted. There were language laws that discriminated against them. And particularly after the Maidan Revolution, or whatever you want to call it, depending on how you see it, but there was a parliament passed a law that would have made it, kind of harder to speak Russian and so on. And you said, and one thing you said that I think is, I didn't know and is not widely known, and I haven't done any fact checking, but a big thing for you was that when that happened, and Russians in the Donbass, which at that part was entirely part of Ukraine, was not yet controlled by separatists, this was the beginning of the separatist movement, did things that you said were analogous to what the more kind of peaceful protesters had done on the Maidan. They held protests, they occupied buildings, they didn't kill anybody. And of course, there are arguments about who killed who first in the Maidan. We won't get into that. But then you say the government immediately treated them as terrorists and started bringing down the violence on them. I'm just saying that by way of review. In this tweet, here's what you say, which kind of goes rather beyond that, I would say, in terms of the aspirations you seem to express. I mean, it goes, well, it's related. You'll hear. So you say it has been 2 years since the beginning of the SMO in the Ukraine. Aside from the internal reflection, you say, in terms of the rest of the world, The main thing we've learned is that they are scared. They are scared because after decades of languid attempts to join the world of cozy consumerist decay, we have started to formulate an idea, by which you mean Russians. It goes on. I won't quote everything. You say, but the idea that Russia is a country of and for Russians and that it will protect Russians with absolute contempt for the illegitimate borders of 1991 and not just the borders. We finally found the courage to say that the entire post-1991 world order, based on a monstrous humiliation and oppression of Russians, must be reevaluated. And it is more than just words. These words are fortified by the hearts and arms of hundreds of thousands of Russian heroes. This prospect has them, meaning some people in the West, shaking with hysterical fear. And then one more line is, this is an idea, in other words, this Russian idea that's motivating you at this point. This is an idea that cannot be refuted by McDonald's and Netflix. And this scares them, meaning some Westerners, because that's all they have. In other words, all they have is this kind of consumerist culture. Now, there's a lot there. But for the time being, I want to focus on the part that I think most people like me would find a little unsettling, the part about with disrespect for existing borders. Now, of course, this is one complaint about the initial invasion to begin with on the West, is that it was a border. And however, I know you believe the border did not align with the kind of organic composition of culture and ethnicity and so on. And that was a problem, you know, but my own view is, you know, borders, there's a lot of borders like that. And if people tried to change them all by force, we'd all be in trouble, right? I mean, as I've told you before, I'm kind of more of a stickler for international law than the people who run American foreign policy is, for example, or perhaps in Vladimir Putin is. But anyway, you see why that would worry people in the West, right? Like, screw the borders, we're going to take whatever land we think is naturally Russian. That's what this sounds like, right?
I wrote a post, so I will be happy to elaborate. I mean, I, like any sane person, would be happy to if that could be done in a peaceful way. Like, for example, Solzhenitsyn himself was very worried about the developments in Ukraine, about NATO influence in Ukraine, and he wrote an article once where he, in a kind of desperate way, tried to come up with a peaceful solution to the whole thing. And he said that there should be referendums, if necessary, region by region, city by city, until there can be found some resolution without bloodshed. Of course, I would be more than happy if such a thing would be possible. Like, I don't think any sane person wants more bloodshed in the world if it can be avoided. Mm-hmm. And I count myself along people who don't want more bloodshed than necessary in the world. But the thing is that I believe that there is a sort of determinism to these things, that countries, nations, over time, if put in some sort of artificial position, will inevitably revert to their natural borders or their natural national psychology, natural behavior. And the question is if it happens in a controlled way or in an uncontrolled way. And I would much prefer it if things were solved in a peaceful and controlled way. But depending on how things go in the next decades, it's going to happen. Like, one thing I always repeat, and that people in the West often don't believe, is that in terms of revanchism, nationalism, expansionism, Putin and the current Russian government are not just moderate, there are like less than moderate. There are there is a very strong current in Russia that is much more hardline, and including among the elites. And Putin does not represent in any way the peak of what an actually like resentful, revanchist Russian government would look like. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be for the best for everyone if such government were not formed. I am more than happy with the moderate approach, at least at the moment. And but some things will have to be solved sooner or later. One example is Kazakhstan, for example. There were riots in Kazakhstan in early 2022. Mm-hmm. A month and a half before the invasion of Ukraine. And the Kazakh government asked the other members of the, I forgot the English acronym, one second, please, CSTO, asked the other CSTO members to help with quelling the civil unrest. And Russia did send troops. I think Armenia and Belarus also sent some troops. And Tajikistan, if I remember correctly. And things worked out more or less. But there are strong currents in Kazakhstan that are very anti-Russia. You have pro-Western circles, but you have also Islamist circles. Those are not necessarily aligned, but both are destabilizing to the situation in Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan is a place that was also formed by communist fiat. And, for example, the northern part of the country, the northern force or so, is still majority ethnic Russian.
And yeah, but of course, I mean, the world is full of these kinds of seemingly arbitrary borders, right? That's kind of my point. Like, what if everyone decided to go to war over those kinds of the lack of correspondence between border in ethnicity?
The problem is that we have precedent in the 90s, in the early 90s, where there were large-scale ethnic cleansings against ethnic Russians in Central Asia, in the Caucasus, in Transcaucasia. The tensions in Moldova, which led to the creation of Transnistria, are also the result of an attempted ethnic cleansing of Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And in Tajikistan, there were massacres of Russians. In Chechnya, of course, which led to the initial invasion under Boris Yeltsin. And I, for one, would not like to see that repeated. I remember my father told me about the refugees who came from Chechnya in the early 90s and who were living in tent cities outside of Moscow because the state was just still reeling from the state collapse. There was no money for anything. No one had money. The economy had collapsed. And there was no one to support these people. And they were living in filthy tent cities.
Ethnically Russian exiles from Chechnya?
Yes.
Kind of? Okay. But Chechnya is a good example. What if the Chechnyans, I mean, in a way, the Chechnyans are saying what you're saying. I mean, maybe, but what if they like said, look, at least part of Chechnya, you have to concede, was ethnically Chechnyan before there was a Russian empire? I mean, I assume that's true. I'm making this up. It could be wrong, but there must be cases where they can point to centuries of habitating land. And what if they said, so this is ours and we're going to do this violently? You could argue that that's what they tried to do in the 90s. Right? I mean, that's what a nationalist insurgency often is.
I don't disagree with that. But, I mean, there was at that time 70 years of peace in that area before that happened.
Well, you understand that a similar reply could be made to you. But anyway, I mean,
I mean, I understand your point. And I guess every sort of cutoff point you make here will be artificial in a sense. That is absolutely true. There is a sort of relativism involved here. It's like, I don't know, the way academia or the UN uses the word indigenous to describe mm-hmm. populations. It's also inconsistent. And obviously, I will be inconsistent here as well because I'm biased towards people who are like me. And I fully admit that, and I have no problem admitting that. But at this point, I have to say that, well, when the bloodshed happens, you have to pick a side.
Well, you can oppose the bloodshed. It sounds to me as if you, first of all, let me, and Nikolai, feel free to join in and chime in at any time, even if it means interrupting me. Okay.
Sure.
If you want to add, first of all, do you want to add, since this was Kirill's tweet we were talking about, do you want to weigh in on where you stand on this?
Not really. I just think that it was a good tweet, probably the best Kirill's post in a while.
Thank you.
Not that like all the rest are garbage, but this is especially good. Yeah.
Okay.
I enjoyed it a lot.
I guess that tells us.
I would like to add a further point to what I said.
Okay.
You said that like the people who live there can say the same, that at some point in time someone else lived there. That is a fair point. That is absolutely a fair point. But if we are at this point, then there is an irreconcilable difference. And historically, this sort of difference is only solved one way, really, through violence. And while I do prefer non-violence to violence, like I said, like every sane person, for example, it would have been so easy to avoid the whole bloodshed that happened in Ukraine. It would have been so easy. They wouldn't even needed to have some kind of Russian puppet government or some pro-Russian president. It would have been enough, at least from the point of view of the people who live in Ukraine, who live in Eastern Ukraine, if they had, laws like in Switzerland, where there are four state languages, that would have not been the optimal outcome from like Russian geostrategic views or whatever, but it would have been a way to completely avoid the civil conflict that broke out.
Yeah, no, I am a longstanding critic of American foreign policy, and I believe that wiser American foreign policy, over the course of a couple of decades, if not longer, could have avoided the whole thing and led to a very different world than we're in. So you don't have to sell me on the idea that the war was avoidable. I'm sure there are probably things both sides could have done, but I'm, as an American, I'm particularly aware, since my job is to, as an American, constructively criticize my own government, I'm particularly aware of ways we screwed up, and I think the fault lies with several presidential administrations, certainly including Biden. And his policies.
Before
the invasion.
It's like our fault too, because Russia ignored or was very bad and ineffective at using soft power for such a long time that the use of hard power became necessary. I see that as a colossal Russian policy failure that it has even come to a war.
Yeah. So as I understand what you said earlier about Putin. And his being more moderate than a number of elements, including in the kind of elite, class. The view you express in this tweet is you think not his view, not his motivating view, and he is that right? That he's more moderate than this?
Yes, I do believe so.
And he,
I think it is in part. Motivation. I don't want to psychoanalyze powerful people. I don't think that's a very good use of anyone's time. But I think there is a lot of spite in the current Russian elites because they really tried to cozy up to the West for decades and were rebuffed at every turn. And the spite can be a very powerful, powerful motivator.
Also, the refusal of the West to recognize Crimea and Crimean referendum was a big thing. And this whole conflict started with Maidan in the Ukraine and then, quote-unquote, annexation of Crimea. Well, yes, there was a military involvement And then there was a referendum, and people of Crimea voted to join Russia. Then the Unified West refused to recognize the people's vote. And the argument was, yeah, look, the Russian army was pointing guns at people, or something like that. Even though Kosovo, the Kosovo had the same, not the same situation, but it had a huge military involvement of the armed Kosovars. And the European Union does not, almost every country in the European Union recognizes Kosovo as an independent state. And it doesn't care for sovereignty and integrity of Serbia.
I agree that the U.S. has been too casual about respecting international law. This is one of my great frustrations.
Actually, I have no idea. Does U.S. recognizes Kosovo? It probably does, right?
Oh, I think it must. I think when it did that, I believe was an irritant to Putin at some point well over a decade ago. I think that was one of the things going around the time of the Georgia-Russia war. And maybe even figured into Putin's motivational structure. I don't know. But I mean, quickly, Kosovo, it's a complicated issue. But the fact is that as a matter of international law, and you can, you know, talk about the atrocities committed on both sides, and I'm willing to, I don't know enough to argue against either position. There were definitely atrocities. There was definitely ethnic cleansing going on the Serbian side. It's also true that the Kosovo Liberation Army was not entirely full of angels. But that aside, as a matter of international law, Kosovo is part of Serbia. NATO intervened militarily without the support of the UN Security Council, which they had with the Bosnia intervention. So that was legal. Kosovo was not. And I know that partly because of Serbia's historical relationship with Russia, that was a much bigger irritant to some Russians than Americans even thought about, right? And anyway, I do think, you know, it's I take the point that it makes it harder for the U.S. to lecture people about not invading countries if they are going to intervene militarily, as in Iraq, whenever they feel like it, without the support of international law. I certainly, you know, I give the same lecture I'm trying to give you to Americans more often than I give it to you about respecting international borders. But see, that's what I'd say about Crimea. You're right that most Crimeans definitely would rather have been part of Russia than Ukraine. There was that referendum. Still, the referendum only happened after some soldiers showed up, even if they didn't have to kill anybody. I don't think they had to kill anybody, did they? Were there any...
I think one Ukrainian soldier was killed during the annexation of Crimea.
So anyway, that's the point, is that there is still, I think, what is a legitimate concern about just not respecting international borders. But we don't need to, you know, hash this out further. I think our respective positions are fairly clear. But on the question of what Putin does and doesn't want. And by the way, I would just pause to reaffirm the idea. And I think this, you tell me, did this play into Putin's psychology to some extent? Now, last time you said you think Putin's main motivation in February of 2022 was the kind of national security consideration that the John Mearsheimers emphasized. In other words, Ukraine was becoming a de facto platform for NATO, even though it wasn't a member. And it kind of was. In fact, we've seen revelations recently about how U.S. helped Ukrainian intelligence establish all of these posts along the Russian border and then had Americans there in the posts and so on. So he found it a threat. That said, I also thought it was to some extent a matter of respect for him, right? Because I do think beginning, you know, around 2000, well, beginning with his tenure, he had made overtures to the Americans that he had reason to feel were not reciprocated. And the Bush administration, I thought, dismissed his concerns fairly cavalierly and so on. Do you think that, and I'm sure he could he can see it both as disrespect for him personally and disrespect for Russia, you know, which after all has nuclear weapons, very big country, always had been taken seriously in the past. Do you think that played a role in his motivation? Because you kind of echo it a little in the tweet I read.
Yeah, I think it, yeah, it, that did play a role, definitely, in the final decision. And because it is like, this guy has been in the game for 25 years. And obviously, like a person who is at the head of a gigantic country with nuclear weapons for a quarter century is a serious person. Like whatever else you may think of him, or whatever else anyone may think of him, that is obviously a serious person who should be taken seriously. And not doing that is probably not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. So if he is not, nonetheless, is not animated by exactly the spirit of your tweet and is more moderate than the tone that that tweet exudes, how far do you think he would go? I mean, first of all, I take his current position to be, tell me if I'm wrong, he's willing to negotiate as long as people understand that the territory the Russian troops occupy, they're not giving back, right? I mean, and he probably wants more than that in the way of, I don't know if he's, I mean, he'd probably still like to have some kind of NATO guarantee. I mean, I will say as a political matter in the U.S. and so on, it's going to be pretty hard to say both, yeah, your troops can stay there, and sure, Ukraine won't join NATO. But that aside, I assume he plans to keep pretty much all the territory he currently occupies. And if that is kind of the informal understanding going into the talks, he's willing to bring the war to an end. Is that fair?
Well, it has been stated many times by various Russian officials, not just Putin, Medvedev too, in more or less the same wording, that the starting point of negotiations would be, as they say, recognition of the realities on the ground, mm-hmm. is what they say, which I take to mean that the four regions that have been formally made part of Russia will be part of Russia, as the like that is non-negotiable. And mm-hmm. Everything else would have to be the result of negotiations. Like that is what I take the statements to mean.
Mm-hmm. And if the war doesn't end and Russia continues, you know, currently the momentum seems to be with Russia. If that continued, how much land would he kind of like to have? I mean, in a way, the question is there some point at which he would just stop? I mean, he would presumably continue until he had the Donbass. He has said, I mean, I think technically, hasn't he already annexed two other oblasts as well in the south? Zaporizhna and
Yes, Kherson and Zaporozhye, yes, they also...
Or Zaporozhye. Yeah, so, and then, of course, I know, partly from listening to your podcast, that Odessa looms large in the psychology of people who think expansively about what Russia is, you know, in some sense entitled to, or, you know, where the natural borders of Russia, I mean, what's this term? Nova, it means new Russia. There was a term
yes,
popular in the, yeah, that included Odessa.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It is the historical name of the region because it was kind of until the 18th century, very sparsely populated. Another name for the region before that was Dikae Pole, which translates to wild field, because there were only nomadic populations there and not really established settlement. And that's why it's called New Russia, because it was kind of like a not exactly like a conquest taken from another country, but like a settlement, a colonial settlement. That's where the term comes from. And it's the historical name for regions, Kharkiv, for example, is not part of historical New Russia, but the Donbas is, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Odessa, Nikolaev, and so on. This is the region that was historically known as New Russia.
So do you think if he continued to have military success, I mean, clearly there would, by your account, be parts of the elite, and I'm sure parts of the grassroots, that would want all of that. You think he would just keep going? Would he stop at that point? As you know, there's a concern in the West that he'll invade Poland and so on.
But I mean, the question is what we mean by going further. Do we mean military occupation or formal incorporation into the Russian Federation? Because those are two different things. Because in terms of if it should be military necessary, then there is not really a reason not to at least temporarily occupy all of Ukraine. But in terms of formal integration into Russia, I think there is a relatively clear line that you can see on any election map ever in Ukraine, that you can see in any language map of Ukraine, that kind of shows which regions would be feasible to incorporate into Russia, because half or more of the population would be okay with that, and regions where this is absolutely not the case, which would require, I don't know, immense amounts of military occupation for decades to pacify them. And I think it is, the line is not super clear, but I think it is relatively easy to tell which regions, which oblasts that would incorporate. And I think the most logical case for, should the situation on the ground arise, for incorporation into Russia would be, like, in addition to the four oblasts that already have been made part of Russia, Kherson, Zaporozhye, Donetsk, and Lugansk. In addition to that, Kharkov, Dnepropetrovsk, Nikolaev, and Odessa. I think that would be reasonable in the sense that it would not require like immense resources to keep the population from rising up or whatever. Because
I think I heard on your podcast a long time ago that in Odessa, although there it is less overwhelmingly Russian in ethnicity and cultural inclination than it was once. And I thought you said it was kind of like about 50-50, but maybe I'm misremembering. I mean, that's a relatively small point. But the main thing is you're saying, although feel free to push back if you think I've got that wrong, but you can see him actually militarily occupying Kyiv and the whole country, but not necessarily having the aspiration to hang on to it. And what about this Poland thing you hear a lot about in the West? That seems to me pretty improbable because Poland is a member of NATO. But what is your take?
I mean, I think it's much more likely that Poland moves into Western Ukraine than that Russia moves into Poland.
You mean against the wishes of the Ukrainians or with their acquiescence given the military position they're in?
I don't think that matters really. I don't think that would matter much in that case if the situation became such that this would become feasible at all.
Okay.
I don't think that anyone plans to annex the western half of Ukraine to the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. I don't think that is anyone's plan in the Kremlin. In terms of the threat that a Ukrainian state that is aligned with NATO would pose to the Russian Federation, this threat would be heavily mitigated by cutting off Black Sea access, which would require controlling all of Nikolaev and Odessa Oblast. And also, like most of Ukraine's functional economy is concentrated in the eastern half of the country.
Yeah.
Which I personally believe was one of the reasons one of the socioeconomic reasons for the, aside from the ethnic side, that there was also a socioeconomic dimension to the conflict between Eastern and Western Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And is there a way of kind of guessing where the weight of Russian public opinion is at both the grassroots level and the elite level about all of this? Like if Putin did end the war now and held on to the territory, the Russian people would by and large be fine with that, I assume. I mean, for political purposes.
I think most normal people, it's hard to say. I mean, at least, like, without at least taking control of all of Donbas, it would be very hard to sell that as a victory.
Really? Yes. But you think Putin would do it?
I mean, there are parts, like parts of Kherson Oblast, parts of Zaporozhye Oblast, parts of Donetsk Oblast, that are formally, according to the Russian constitution, part of the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. And I don't see how one could sell, like, breaking your own constitution in a peace treaty as a victory. Well,
you mean by virtue of the annexation, they are now part of the...
Yes, yes.
The unilateral annexation, right. But all... That's a lot of territory. If you're talking about all four oblasts, I mean, one is mainly, you know, pretty predominantly under Russian control already, I know, but that's a lot of land, right? To get all four of those provinces and leave Odessa aside. But
It is much less than already is under Russian control.
So,
I mean, it's like about half of Donetsk Oblast. About, I don't know, a third of the Zaporozhye Oblast and like a third of Kherson Oblast. I think it is vaguely possible that the current front lines could be frozen and there could be some sort of treaty. I don't think that's impossible, but I think it would be very hard for the Kremlin to spin this as a victory and as having achieved the goals of the special military operation, which have from day one been proclaimed as protecting the Donbas. And if like a fourth or a fifth of the Donbas remains under Kiev control, I don't see how that could be spun as a victory.
But that wouldn't be a big political threat to Putin. He could sell it for practical purposes, right?
That's hard to say. It's hard to say.
Even if you look at the polling firm that the West recognizes as the most reliable or the whatever polling outfit, I don't know if it's a nonprofit or what, but that the West respects as the most reliable thing in Russia, he's got like an 80% approval rating, right? And I mean, your sense is that, yeah, he is actually quite popular now, partly because of the kind of wartime mentality that we talked about, I guess, but I don't know. What do I know? But whereas you would say that if he actually surrenders significant territory, says, okay, as part of this deal, we'll withdraw the troops from X, Y, and Z, any appreciable part of Ukrainian territory, you think that would be a serious political problem for him? Do you? I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Like I was going to say, I think it's kind of a wild card is that like half a million people who have sat under artillery and missile strikes for this land and what kind of political effect it will have when these people go home.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's possible that everything would be smoothed over, I guess, but it's also possible that there would be a very strong revanchist current in Russian politics.
Mm. Okay, well, listen, we've reached the end of the public part of the podcast. We're going to keep talking. Thanks for sticking around to listen to the rest. People should, if they want, become paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. Google Non-Zero on Substack or just click the thing in your show notes of your podcast app. Once you've done that, there's a post at Substack that represents that is this podcast. You can go right there and listen to the rest of it. But more important, there's also a way right there in the same post to set up a podcast feed so that forevermore you'll have access to the whole things. Before we go, I want to say first of all, I know you guys like to emphasize that the Russians with Attitude podcast before the war was mainly about Russian culture and history,
and it still has a lot
of that. What's that?
Sure.
And
tourism and music as well. I'm going to Dagestan, and I will make a tourist guide about Dagestan. So yeah, we are the biggest hub of all things Russian in the English language. So we do podcasts on Russian news, politics, history, tourism, and reality. So if you're interested, I welcome you to our community.
And is there anything you want to say by way, and just quickly in closing, maybe Nikolai, I should ask you, since you seem to have been busy parenting for parts of this.
Yeah.
Anything you want to say aside from the fact that you're a good father?
Yeah, I'm also, well, I'm not that bad as an interviewer, but I'm pretty bad as an interviewee. So I apologize. Really, yeah. But I will be more talkative in the paid non-zero.
Yeah, that's what we promised them. That's what they should pay for.
Yeah, is exactly.
Nikolai Unplugged, we call this part of the podcast. You haven't,
exactly.
You really haven't
never
lived
do anything
until...
for free. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Are you willing to, for enough money, are you willing to turn the camera on?
Yeah,
we
sure,
crowd,
for enough
we
money.
We can crowdfund. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my new business model. Okay. Well, listen, thank you for coming on the podcast. And thanks. I've been on your podcast. I don't know if I remember to say that, but thanks for having me. And thanks to everybody who's listened to this much, whether you're going to stay with us for the rest or not.